to that man behind the curtain.
All that hate's gonna burn you up, kid.
Keeps me warm.
You'll put down your rock and I'll put down my sword and try and kill each other like civilized people.
Welcome to episode 5 of the Red 7 Movie Cast, the official podcast of the Rouge Cinema. I'm your host, Hemanth Naidu, and you can follow me on Twitter and on Letterboxd at HJNaidu. That's H-J-N-A-I-D-U. So we're 1 week into January, and I've kicked off a couple of film projects for myself. So the first one is Frozen Fest 2018. So in January, each year, I challenge myself to watch 30 movies in 30 days. So these can be new films or rewatches, as long as I watch them in a public theater or in my home theater. Watching movies just on a TV, I don't count that, because so many times I just have a movie on in the background, or I'm, you know, doing something else on the couch, I just have a movie on, and even though I watch the whole movie, I typically wouldn't consider that an actual rewatch. So it has to be a real watch in a public theater or a home theater. So I started this off 3 years ago, and back then I called it 30 and 30, just doing 30 films in 30 days. And then last year, I renamed it to 30 Fest. But this year, I thought the name Frozen Fest was a little bit more fitting, since I do it in January, and January is a pretty frigid month where I live. That seemed like a pretty good name, Frozen Fest. And what better way to get through January in this crazy cold than to watch movies? So it is tough to watch, for me anyways, to watch 30 movies in 30 days, having a full-time job and two kids. During the week, it's not a lot of time to watch a movie. I basically got a small window there every night. And plus, I watch a lot of NBA and Toronto Raptors basketball, so trying to fit that in as well, you know, just adds to the difficulty. And this year, I think it's going to be a little bit harder for me even more. Last year or so, I've been trying to get a little bit more fit, so the only time I really have time to work out or to run is early in the morning before I go to work. So every day I'm up at 5 a.m., meaning I'm in bed at 10 p.m. the night before. So that really cuts down on the amount of time that I have to watch a film. So it is an extra challenge to try and get that in there. But I mean, I got through the first week, so I think I can pull it off. So I have this list of movies that I plan to watch in the next 30 days on my Letterboxd account, so the list is public and you can go check it out there. I will put the link in the show notes. So I mentioned that I had two projects. The second one is 52 films directed by women. So last year I came across this list in Letterboxd where someone had put together a list of movies directed by women that they were going to try and work through over the year. So I copied that list into my Letterboxd account and just kind of put it on the back burner, thinking it would be a pretty cool idea to do. So this year, I decided, well, I'm going to go for it. And I took that list and I heavily modified it and pulled off the movies that I'd already seen. And I swapped out quite a few for ones that I found a little bit more interesting than the ones that were on there. And so I got it down to 52. And my plan is to watch one of these movies every week. I think it's going to be a pretty good exercise just to see, you know, possibly a different perspective from women filmmakers, knowing that I'm going into this movie and then knowing that it's directed by a woman. I can try and, you know, focus a little bit more on, you know, noticing some of these differences and just noticing that maybe different styles or different ways the stories are told, and see if I can broaden my horizons a little bit, I guess. This seemed like a good project. Just right now it's pretty big news, lack of diversity in the film industry, just the lack of women leads, women directors, people of color. So there's not a lot that I can do personally. So I thought this was the least I could do to show some support and at least add some awareness to the issue. And I think it's just a good exercise to go through for me. This list is also on my Letterboxd account and it is public, so I will add a link in the show notes if you want to go check that out. Add any comments or suggestions for movies you think should be on there. I'd like to hear. So that takes us into the films that I watched in the last 7 days.
When I was young, Padawana, I knew what peace felt like. Stories remain in our hearts even when all else is gone. Padawana, were you listening at all?
Yes, Papa.
Why is this girl not at home?
She should cover herself properly.
Maybe you should stop looking at her.
I can have you killed!
I think business will pick up.
If there are women
Papa?
Present, cover yourself now!
Where is he being taken?
To prison.
Papa! It will be all right.
So that was a clip from the trailer of The Breadwinner, directed by Noura Toumi, starring Sara Chowdhury, Soma Chaya, and Nooran Gholamgas. The letterbox description is, a headstrong young girl in Afghanistan disguises herself as a boy in order to provide for her family. So this is actually the first film in my 52 Film Directed by Women project, and seemed like a good way to start off the year. So the main premise of this one is a young girl, Parvana, who has a father, a mother, an older sister, and a younger baby brother. The father is arrested at his house for being an enemy of the state. No real reason is given, and he's taken off and he's imprisoned. So that leaves the family in quite a dilemma, because all that's left is the girls and the young infant boy. So there's no way for them to leave the house, because they have to, in order for them to leave the house, they need to be accompanied by a man, because they are now, they're living in Taliban-controlled Kabul, and the only man in their house, or only male in their house now, is an infant boy. So they can't leave the house to go get food, to go sell things, to make money. So they're in a pretty big dilemma. So Parvana comes up with the idea to pretend she's a boy. So she cuts her hair and puts on some boy's clothes and decides to head to the market that she always went to with her dad and try and sell stuff and make some money and be able to go out and buy some food for her family. So this movie is rated PG-13, and I'm not sure it's actually, I don't think it's targeted at kids or older kids, because it is quite violent at times. There's not a lot of violence, but when there is, it's pretty hard-hitting, and it's, you definitely feel it. I found myself trying to imagine what this movie would be like if it were not animated, because it was already difficult to watch in a lot of these scenes, and thinking about it being in, you know, a live-action movie, it'd be very difficult, very much more difficult. So I think it as an animated movie was, you know, helped because you were able to show a lot of this stuff, but maybe not turn off a lot of people, you know, if it was more graphic as a live action. But yeah, the animation style is pretty interesting. It looks really simple. It's not 3D animation. It's two-dimensional, and it looks like it's hand-drawn, and it's, like I said, quite simple, and I think it feels fitting for the story that's being told. So the story is mainly about, I think the main theme is just courage. We see Parvana, even though people think she's a boy out there, she is, you know, the lengths she goes through, the risks she takes to be able to provide for her family and to make strides in trying to go see her father in the prison and trying to rescue her father. It's pretty amazing just to see what she goes through in that. the scene when she goes out the first time as a boy, and the joy on her face that she see, the joy in her face, and just her, I guess, her reaction to being able to, when she realizes she's able to just go out, do anything she wants, go anywhere she wants. Even though the animation, I think it like I said, the animation's really simple, but you get that sense from her just through the acting. I think the acting's really, really well done. So there's a scene when Parvana first goes out as a boy, and she's out on the streets, and she goes into a store, and it's a store she had gone to before and got thrown out because she wasn't being accompanied by a man. So she goes back in there, and everyone's so nice to her, thinking she's a boy, and they help her out and, you know, give her whatever she needs. And just the look on her face and the way the voice acting is done for this, when she realizes that she can do anything she wants now because she is quote unquote a boy, she can go anywhere she wants. So that realization was really, really great to see. And also really, really devastating, considering, you know, this is stuff she can only do because she is a man, or a boy, I guess. It kind of reminded me a little bit of a movie I saw quite a while ago, probably 15 years ago. I think it was called Osama. So the story was a different type of story, but the premise was where a young girl in Afghanistan dresses up like a boy and pretends to be a boy to, you know, to avoid all the injustices against her. So that was actually a really good movie too, so I would suggest checking that out if you haven't seen that one. But yeah, The Breadwinner, the only really nitpicky thing I can think about it that didn't really do it for me was throughout the story, Parvana is telling this other story to various people. She tells it to her brother, she tells it to her sister and her mother, and I found that story to be a little bit distracting. It was also about courage, and it did tie into the story the story of herself. But I think I always found myself looking forward to getting back to her story and the main story. But that's a pretty small nitpick, and I was trying to think of things I didn't really care for in the movie, and that was the only thing that came up. So my rating for The Breadwinner is 4.5 out of 5. The second movie I watched was The Dark Tower. Here's a clip from the trailer.
These visions, as you call them. What do you see?
I see a tower.
A man in black.
And the gunslinger.
They're just dreams. They're not real, Jake.
There's another world out there.
I know there is.
Who are you?
It's you. You're a gunslinger, right?
There are no gunslingers. Not anymore.
The letterbox description is, the last gunslinger, Roland Deschain, has been locked in an eternal battle with Walter O'Dim, also known as the Man in Black, determined to prevent him from toppling the Dark Tower, which holds the universe together. With the fate of the world at stake, good and evil will collide in the ultimate battle, as only Roland can defend the tower from the Man in Black. Directed by Nicolas Arcel, starring Idris Elba, Matthew McConaughey, and Tom Taylor. So I know going into this movie that it was quite hated and critically did not do very well. So I had pretty low expectations, but as I was watching it, first 10 minutes in, I was thinking to myself, I'm actually enjoying this, I'm not minding this at all. And as the movie went on, I kept expecting myself, you know, something to, you know, just for myself to lose interest in it or just to think it was stupid. But I don't know, it went through it all and I didn't think it was awesome or anything, but I enjoyed it. I had a good time with it. So I was trying to think about why I enjoyed it when everyone or most everyone else hated it. And the only thing I could think of was, well, I didn't read the books and I knew zero about the story going into this. I had no idea what it was about. So I'm not sure if that helped a bit, because I know a lot of people that didn't like it were people that read the books, and maybe that helped for me. But I know it's not a long movie. It's only, I think it's less than 90 minutes, and it's based on, I guess the books, there's a series and they're, I think it's 7 books long. So I can see if people had read a 7-book series and they condensed it down to a 90-minute movie, I can see how that could probably be a pretty terrible thing. So with me not knowing anything that went on in those stories, I just went into it, you know, with basically as a fresh story for me and a pretty open mind. And yeah, I did not mind it at all. Well, actually, after I watched it, I asked my wife if, because she had read the books, she didn't watch the movie with me, but she did read the books. And this story focuses on a boy named Jake. I think he's maybe 13 years old, maybe 15 years old. And he has these dreams, really vivid dreams, where he sees things that are happening, events and people. And he wakes up and he draws these pictures of these people. So we're seeing it from his perspective. And slowly, you know, he starts to get more and more into the story of the gunslinger and the man in black. And he gets into basically their world. So I really like that, seeing he was the audience surrogate. And I liked how he was used to take us along the ride. And as we were going on, kind of early on in the movie, maybe the first half hour, I was thinking to myself that it felt, I kind of got the same vibe I got from The Neverending Story. The stories aren't at all the same, but there was something there that made me feel like the feeling I got from The Neverending Story. So something definitely I think that could have been improved on was, like I said, this is a pretty short movie, 90 minutes. And most of the story is based on the relationship between the man in black and Jake, the boy. So they meet and the relationship gets pretty strong pretty quickly, kind of a father-son relationship. And there's not a lot of time given to that. It's just, it kind of just happens out of nowhere and we're just expected to feel that connection between the two. So I think that's definitely where the movie fails a bit, is I think they could have spent significantly more time on building that relationship. And I think that would have helped make it feel a little bit more believable. Just the relationship we see later on in the movie, it just didn't feel organic. It just felt like they had this relationship because that's the way it was written. And also in their world, they're trying to find the man in black and find his headquarters. And I think the idea was that they were going through this long, epic journey. And we never really get the sense of that. It just feels like they suddenly get there. And it just, we don't get the feeling that they made this giant journey. And I think if they would have spent a little bit more time on the journey and just showing the vastness of the land and just given something to give it that epic feel, I think that would have really gone a long way. I think to the Lord of the Rings and the journey you go on with those guys, you feel it, you feel the length of the journey, you feel the struggle they go through. And I think something like that was supposed to be here as well. Like I said, I didn't read the book, so I'm not sure if that's the case, but I think that's what they were going for. And I think that's probably what it was supposed to be, but that they just didn't pull that part off. I'm not sure, maybe that might have been budget stuff. I don't know. I think this was a pretty low budget movie, so that could have played into it as well. But overall, I mean, like I said, I didn't mind it. I think the ending, it kind of comes up pretty quick. And this final battle between the man in black and the gunslinger, it's a pretty quick battle. And it just kind of ends quite quickly. So I think that would have been nice to have seen that a little bit more, a little bigger battle there. But like I said, maybe that's just because of the low budget, and that's, they did what they could do. Something else I did like about this was Idris Elba and the boy leave his world and they end up back on Earth. And so we get this little bit of a fish out of water thing with Idris Elba's character, the gunslinger. So there's a lot of humor around that. And I don't know, I found it pretty funny. I found myself laughing at it. I think Idris Elba did a pretty good job. He was really good as a gunslinger. He totally pulled that off, and he's just this cool cowboy type guy. He does these really cool ways he reloads his gun. I think he's got a six shooter and a lot of cool visuals on that of how he's in these big battles and he's able to load these two six shooters up really quickly. Lots of cool stuff around that. And just him as the character, he feels pretty good. He's probably the best thing in the movie for sure. Matthew McConaughey, I think a lot of people hated him in this. He is a little bit odd. I'm not sure he was the best person to play the role, but I don't know. I didn't mind him in it. I like McConaughey, and I thought he was okay as this devil-like person. I'm not sure the significance of the Man in Black, but I thought he was okay. So, yeah, 90-minute movie, not a lot of time. I'd say give it a try if you don't know anything about it. Probably if you read the books, you're not going to like it, but if you haven't, if you can go into it fresh, I think you could have some fun with it. I give The Dark Tower 3.5 out of 5.
We need you to deliver stuff for us.
Oh, this is legal?
If you're doing it for the good guys.
Barry Seals, a goddamn genius!
You are an airline pilot, Barry. That's how you support this family.
This is gonna be good for us.
Is this all legal?
You trust me?
No!
We're expanding operations, Barry!
The devil you know, the devil you know, the devil you don't.
Roscoe dug this up in the backyard. There are bills blown around everywhere.
I'll rake it up in the morning.
That was a clip from American Made, directed by Doug Liman, starring Tom Cruise, Domhnall Gleeson, and Sarah Wright. The Letterboxd description is, the true story of pilot Barry Seal, who transported contraband for the CIA and the Medellin cartel in the 1980s. So this, I didn't actually know anything about this movie, and I had never even heard of it. I just noticed it. I was going through iTunes, and I noticed American Made, and I saw that Tom Cruise is in it. And I just said to myself, how have I not heard of this? It's basically a classic rise and fall story of this guy. He was a pilot, commercial airline pilot, and next thing you know, he's in the CIA, getting them intelligence from Central America, and basically he becomes on the side while doing this reconnaissance for the CIA. He starts getting involved in the drug trade and transporting, I guess, cocaine or heroin or whatever it was into the United States. So I think Liman was going for a Goodfellas kind of vibe. It definitely feels that way, just this, you know, in that we see Ray Liotta's character rise up in the ranks, making tons of money, and then basically it all coming crashing down on him. So basically the same thing here. The only thing is, this one really is lacking any of the violence you would expect with the drug trade. Everything here just seems like everything's happy-go-lucky, everyone's having a great time, everyone's making money, even though we're seeing, you know, Pablo Escobar and the guys he was with, and so it was pretty weird to watch this movie dealing with the drug trade and seeing zero violence and zero, you know, of the crazy crap that goes on in every other drug-related movie when you're dealing with these cartels. So I'm not sure the reason for that. Maybe that wasn't what this story was about, but it was a little bit weird not seeing any of that stuff, and it took away, I think, from a little bit of the reality. So Tom Cruise, he's his basic, usual, charismatic guy. I think we've seen this type of stuff in every other Tom Cruise film where it's just that same smile and, you know, the laugh and all that stuff. So I didn't know if that's how the real Barry Seal was or if this was just how they were portraying him because Tom Cruise was playing him. So I looked up and read a little bit about Barry Seal, and apparently that's how he was. He was really charismatic and people loved him. So I guess he didn't look anything like Tom Cruise. The real Barry Seal was quite heavy, and I think they said his nickname was El Gordo, which is the big one or something like that. So we see Jesse Plemons in the film. He plays a policeman, I guess he's the sheriff maybe, in the town Mena, where Tom Cruise and his family base themselves out of. So we see Jesse Plemons, and I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. He's in this, but he's basically not in it at all. He played a very minor role, zero impact on the story. So it was a little bit odd seeing him in there and not utilized at all. Another unfortunate thing was, I think the women characters were underwritten. His wife, played by Sarah Wright, she was just there more or less to give Barry Seal, Tom Cruise's character, someone to protect, someone to care for, and just, you know, add a little bit of tension in Barry Seal's life, just, you know, with this crazy stuff he was doing. But as a character, Sarah Wright's character, we have no idea how she actually felt about what was going on. Did she know anything about what was going on? Did she know what her husband was doing? We have no idea. It's not even presented as a question. It's just, she's just there. And, you know, even though Tom Cruise, Barry Seal, you know, uproots his family in the middle of the night and says, we got to move to, I think they were in Louisiana. We got to move right now from Louisiana to Arkansas. And there's a little bit of pushback from his wife, but in the end, you know, 2 minutes later, she's with him and they're gone. So that was a little bit unfortunate, because I think there was probably a lot that could have been told from her character's perspective based on just the craziness that was going on. And overall, Barry Seal, I'm not sure he even had a real arc as a character. I was trying to think about, you know, where he started off at the beginning and how did his character change by the end, other than him, you know, going through this rise and fall. Him as a character, I'm not sure he learned anything. He was just, at the end of it, I think he had the same attitude, and I think he had the same feelings towards everything he did. So that was a little bit odd. So this movie was, I had a pretty good time watching it. It was, kind of had this feel-good movie throughout the whole thing. We're just seeing him having a good time with his friends, making all this money, just getting richer and richer, so much richer, so much money, you know, they don't know what to do with it, they don't have room for any of the money, and, you know, it's set to this music, this cool 70s music, or 80s music, and we just don't see that bad side of the drug trade, and you get no sense of danger. So for what it was a pretty good time. I had a good time with it. It's definitely not in it, not like Goodfellas, not in the same class as that, but I had a good time with it. And I give this one a 4 out of 5. The fourth movie I watched was A Ghost Story.
When I was little, we used to move all the time. I would write these in notes, and I would fold them up really small. And I would hide them.
What'd they say?
They were just like things I wanted to remember, so that if I ever wanted to go back, there'd be a piece of me there waiting.
So that was a clip from the trailer, directed by David Lowery, starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. The description is, recently deceased, a white-sheeted ghost returns to his suburban home to console his bereft wife, only to find that in a special state, he has become unstuck in time, forced to watch passively as the life he knew and the woman he loves slowly slip away. So I didn't know anything going into this movie either, but man, I loved this movie a lot, and I'm not quite sure why. I just liked, it just looked beautiful, it felt beautiful to me. Just the way that it was shot. So it was shot in an aspect ratio of 4:3, which is usually not something I like, but so this one is 4:3, plus it had rounded corners, so it, you know, it had this 8mm type film feel to it. Every shot in it, almost every shot, looked like a vintage photo, and just the way they were framed, the lighting, I think he used a lot of natural lighting. Everything just looked gorgeous, and I think every frame could have been a photo, and I just loved all of it, the way it looked. And it reminded me a lot, I guess, it reminded me a lot of Instagram, as you're scrolling through Instagram, and you come across some of these really great photos. It gave me that vibe, and it worked for me. So mostly the story, I think, the way I took it was a story about grief, but not from the perspective of, you know, someone who has lost someone who has died, but from the perspective of the person who has died, and for them dealing with, you know, not being in the lives of the people they love, and them having, I guess, the ability to continue to watch those people's lives and not be part of it, and just dealing with watching those people as their lives continue and as they move on past, you know, their losses. So I think that was a pretty interesting and unique perspective on grief. So this one is definitely, it's a slow burn. It moves pretty slowly at the beginning, I don't think you feel it. I didn't feel it. And it was paced well for me. And I think definitely the last third of this film is definitely stronger than the first couple acts. Once we get into the third act, I think the pace is a lot better and everything just moves better. And by the time you're done, it just, you know, starts to tie everything that you've seen previously. It ties it all up and ties it all up together. And I think definitely the third is the strongest part. The scene you probably will hear most about is there's this scene, 5 minute scene, it's easily 5 minutes, literally 5 minutes, of Rooney Mara's character eating a pie. And that's it. She's starts off standing there above a table eating a pie, picks it up, starts eating it more, sits down against the counter and continues to eat this pie, probably eats maybe half of the pie, but it just keeps going on and on and on. 5 minutes, at least 5 minutes. I should look back and see how long it actually was. So as you're watching it, you're wondering what the heck is going on here? Why am I watching this for 5 minutes? And I think by the time you're done the film, I think maybe if you think back to it, you can realize why that scene was in there and what the purpose of it was. I think it helped to give kind of a perspective of Casey Affleck's character as the ghost, because he's watching her eat this pie the whole time in the background. So I think that gave a little bit of a perspective on how time was, you know, how time was for him. He's just, that was his life now, just watching from the sidelines and just not being part of it, but all he can do is sit there and watch. So I'm not sure if that was the reason for it. That's kind of how I took it, and I think it worked. Once the film's done, I think you can make sense of it. So the only thing I think about this film that I didn't really care for, or the least thing I liked about it, was there's a scene where there's this house party going on, and there's a guy who goes off on this long monologue about time and existence and people's legacies and his, you know, how you are deemed important or how you're remembered throughout history and what, you know, if that's important or not. So I think it's pretty on the nose of what the film is about. And the guy, I don't know, the way the guy tells this story, I wasn't a huge fan of the performance of that, and it seemed a little bit too much, but overall it didn't affect my enjoyment of the film. But I think that was probably the weakest part of the story for sure. But I definitely would recommend this to anyone if you've not seen it. I give A Ghost Story 5 out of 5.
Hello?
Eureka, Billie Jean!
It's Bobby Riggs. Listen, I had a great idea.
Male chauvinist pig versus hairy leg feminist. No offense.
You're still a feminist, right?
I'm a tennis player who happens to be a woman.
Don't hang up.
By the way, I shave my legs.
We are privileged tennis fans to have the great Billie Jean King.
Ain't got
Word is, you are a renegade.
Women should be paid and respected equally.
I admire what you guys are doing.
You're offering the men's winner 8 times what you're offering the women's winner.
The men are simply more exciting to watch. It's just biology.
I am not saying that women don't belong on the court. Who would pick up the balls otherwise?
Oh, my God.
You know what I'm doing? I'm cooking. I'm cooking.
There isn't a single thing I don't hate about Bobby Riggs.
$100,000 to any woman who can beat Bobby Riggs. Is she out there, and does she have the nerve?
Call Bobby. Tom, it's on.
So that was a clip from Battle of the Sexes, directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, starring Emma Stone, Steve Carell, and Andrea Riseborough. The Letterboxd description is the true story of the 1973 tennis match between world number one Billie Jean King and ex-champ and serial hustler Bobby Riggs. So I think the most interesting part of this movie was how they decided to focus not on the tennis match itself and all the hubbub around that, but actually on the personal lives of Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, and just dealing with the problems, the struggles they were having in their families, and how a lot of that stuff, or I guess almost all of that, was reasons for the match in the first place. So even though we do get to see the match played out in the end, I think that was definitely secondary to, I guess, the character study of the two main people. Something I did learn from this film was I didn't really realize that Bobby Riggs actually played a different woman tennis player before Billie Jean King. He actually played Margaret Court first. So I did not know that. So that was something I learned from the movie. Steve Carell, I wasn't sure what to think of him as I was watching this. I didn't really know how Bobby Riggs was. This was before my time. So I didn't know what kind of person this guy was. And Steve Carell seemed to be doing, you know, his basic Steve Carell stuff. So I thought maybe it seemed like to me that he was miscast. But then I did a little bit of research and I looked him up, and man, they looked almost exactly the same in the photos I saw, at least. And apparently that's how Bobby Riggs was, just, you know, the way that he was portrayed in the movie. So it was good to see that actually fit, and they weren't just, you know, making this kind of comedic type stuff just based on who they had playing him and Steve Carell. I think Emma Stone was pretty awesome as Billie Jean King. No makeup or anything to make her look like it, or prosthetics, but man, she looked a lot like her, just the way she carried herself. And, you know, just the way they did her up, her hair and all that, it's pretty cool. I guess the stuff she's going through in the film, you know, trying to come to terms with her sexuality and how that's affecting her relationship. I think that was a pretty interesting, probably the most interesting part of the movie. You know, she's dealing with, you know, women's liberation, and then she's dealing with her sexuality, and everything's just kind of coming to head. And that was probably, like I said, that was the strongest part of the movie for me. It was nice to see Elizabeth Shue in this movie. I haven't seen her in a long time. I'm not sure if she's been in anything recently, so it was pretty good to see her. And I liked her character as Bobby Riggs' wife, and how she had to deal with him and his craziness of being a gambler and a hustler. And just her demeanor of dealing with him, dealing with his flaws, even though she so loved him. And Sarah Silverman's in there as, I guess, she's organizing the women's league that they put together at the beginning of the movie. And her character, I don't know, I didn't like her character. I didn't like her performance. It seemed like it didn't belong. It seemed like it was from Saturday Night Live or something. It just did not fit in there for me, and that did not do it for me. I'm not sure if the character she was playing was a real character, and maybe that's how the person was, but it just seemed like it did not fit in the movie. So once we start getting into the lead up to the tennis match, we basically see the men in the film. They're basically, the only thing I could think of was they were basically just like the internet trolls we see today, but this was in the 70s and they were just doing it on TV and in newspapers, and it was pretty eye-opening to see the way people spoke back then on this subject. It's pretty sad. And it was pretty interesting the way they show Bobby Riggs and the men, how they're treating this whole tennis match and the whole idea of what the significance of it as a joke. They, you know, it's just a big joke to them and they're just having a good time with it, oblivious to the fact that the significance it is for the women and how much it means to them and just the real implications it has on their lives. So you see these two ends. One end is just joking around. They don't care. It means nothing to them. And then on the other side you have, you know, it's their life. It's everything for them. There's another great scene in the movie. There's while the tennis match is going on, and we see a couple guys watching on TV, and they're in this, looks like some sort of men's lounge or something, and they're watching and they're getting pretty uncomfortable now that Bobby Riggs is losing. And we see this woman serving them their drinks, and she kind of moves off into the background behind them while they're watching, and they're getting pretty uncomfortable, you know, because Bobby Riggs is losing now. And we just kind of, the camera pans up a bit and pushes in on that woman server and just the smile on her face, the joy as she's seeing what's unfolding before her and them. It's a great scene. So I think the pacing was pretty good for the most part. I think it dragged a little bit in the middle for me, but overall, I think it moved well. And once you get to the tennis match, the tennis looked really good. It looked like a real match. They were using the same camera angles, I think, that they use for tennis. And you got the feeling that they were actually playing. I'm not sure how they did it, but it looked really good. And just to add to the realism, I like how they use the actual play-by-play by Howard Cosell. I think that really helped sell the whole event. But overall, I think this is a pretty enjoyable movie. I had a pretty good time with it. Performances were great. The story was great and moved along well. And I give this one a 4 out of 5.
Sheriff's office.
I need emergency assistance.
What's your location?
The Wind River Indian Reservation.
I'm Jane Banner, FBI.
Welcome to Wyoming.
You by yourself?
It's just me.
That's Corey Lambert. He's the one who found the body.
This is a homicide.
I knew that girl. She's a fighter.
They have 6 officers to cover an area the size of Rhode Island. Maybe you can help.
Well, I know what the tracks say.
What is it that you do again?
Hunt predators.
So why don't you come hunt one for me then?
That is a clip from the trailer for Wind River, directed by Taylor Sheridan, starring Jeremy Renner, Elizabeth Olsen, Graham Greene, Kelsey Asboland, and John Bernthal. The letterbox description is, an FBI agent teams with the town's veteran game tracker to investigate a murder that occurred on a Native American reservation. So this one, when I was watching it, felt a lot like Fargo to me, kind of had that same feel, plus a little bit like Thunderheart as well. I mean, story is very similar. Investigation of a murder on a Native American reservation. So this one has a very similar pace to Sheridan's last movie, Hell or High Water. And so it moves along slowly, but it doesn't feel slow at all. It's a good pace. Jeremy Renner, he's really good as the lead. He plays a guy who's, you know, really good at his job as a tracker slash hunter, but he carries with him this quietness or this sadness from a tragedy that's happened to his family. You don't really know early on what happened. And as the film goes on, they start to reveal it a little bit more, and it starts to make a little bit more sense of why he is the way he is and why he has invested so much in this investigation. Elizabeth Olsen, she actually does a really good job as well as this FBI agent who basically is out of her element right now, you know, in the dead of winter on this reservation, out in the middle of nowhere, and she shows up basically not prepared for the cold weather. She just basically has a small jacket and, you know, no boots, no anything you need for cold winter weather. Comes in there needing help right off the bat. She's in this dead of winter. She's stationed in Las Vegas and grew up in Fort Lauderdale, and now she's out in, you know, out in the country in minus 20 degree weather. So she does a good job just portraying herself as, I mean, she's playing a strong woman as this FBI agent, but she's vulnerable just to her surroundings. And Graham Greene is in here, and he's always good. I'm not sure I've ever seen him not do a nice job. So this movie is not really a procedural like maybe you would expect for a FBI investigation. It's more or less focusing just on the people and, I guess, the struggles that they're all going through, and just, you know, living where they live and in the situation that they're in. They do a nice job of giving us a look at that, and so it does a good job of putting into the spotlight the problem of missing Indigenous women and how that is, you know, an ignored problem. And we get to see firsthand as, you know, people trying to deal with that, and with the little resources they have, trying to, you know, solve the problems when they do know someone's gone missing. So the climax for this one just comes out of nowhere, and it takes you by surprise. I didn't really realize that was at the end of the movie yet, and then basically all hell breaks loose, gets really violent, gets real really fast, and it's got a good gritty feel to it. The ending is quite satisfying from the perspective of justice, I guess, and also satisfying once we start to see the healing starting at the end of the movie for everyone involved. So this one, I hadn't heard of this one, I think, before yesterday when I watched it, and I was just scrolling through iTunes looking for something to watch, and this one came up in the list of new. And it looked interesting to me, so I checked it out, saw it was by Taylor Sheridan, and that was definitely interesting to me after Hell or High Water. And yeah, I'm not disappointed at all. Turned out really great. I give Wind River 4.5 out of 5.
Go the way you think. Fulfill your destiny.
I need someone to show me my place in all this.
So I think that is the third time I played a clip from this trailer. That was from Star Wars The Last Jedi, directed by Rian Johnson, starring Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, Oscar Isaac, and Adam Driver. The letterbox description is, Rey develops her newly discovered abilities with guidance of Luke Skywalker, who is unsettled by the strength of her powers. Meanwhile, the Resistance prepares to do battle with the First Order. So I think the last few episodes I had mentioned that I still hadn't seen The Last Jedi a second time, so I really wanted to see it a second time to kind of get my final feelings on the movie. I knew that a second viewing was gonna play differently than my first, and I was looking forward to seeing it a second time. Plus, my oldest son, who is 7, he had been wanting to go see it, and we just hadn't got a chance to see it since it opened together. So we finally went today, and yeah, I was about the same age. He's about the same age as I was when I saw Return of the Jedi in the theaters in 1983. So I was looking forward to seeing how he took this one. And for me, I definitely liked it a lot better on my second viewing. I think just going into this one this time, I knew the story, I knew what happened, and my expectations were gone. And I was able to just focus on everything else. I was just able to focus on the story, just the visuals, and performances, I guess, and just some of the nuances that were there without having to, you know, worry about fulfilling some of my expectations that I may have had. So this time, after watching it, I think it felt a lot like Empire Strikes Back to me this time around. Just the way Rey leaves Luke, same circumstances as when Luke left Yoda on Dagobah in Empire. I think that was a pretty good parallel there. And just by the end of this, where the rebels, I mean, they've just been devastated, nothing left, and they're just left to regroup, very similar to the end of Empire Strikes Back. So I think, for whatever reason, yeah, this time around, really liked it. With Luke's character, I think I still would have liked to have seen him handled differently. I would like to have seen him in a more positive light this time around, but I think I can definitely buy into his story and the way Rian Johnson decided to tell it. And I think his arc as a character, not through this film, but just through the entire series from A New Hope to The Last Jedi, I think that is an interesting arc, and I hope that we do get to see more of Luke in episode 9 and maybe see his arc completed. Because even though he died at the end of The Last Jedi, I do think there's more for his character to go through and, you know, to kind of get to his final state of mind, I guess. So I'm surprised how much more I liked it second time around. I was saying, so my initial rating for this was a 4 out of 5. And I think in that review of the movie, I had mentioned that on a second viewing, I predicted that I'd go up to a 4.5 out of 5. But I think after watching it today, I think this is a solid 5 out of 5 for me. Happy to say that. So that's it for week one of Frozen Fest 2018 and 52 films directed by women. You can find more episodes of this podcast at red7cast.com. And you can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. And you could also really help me out. I'd appreciate it if you were to give me a star rating and a review, preferably positive, on those services, especially iTunes. And like I said at the beginning, you can find me on Twitter and on Letterboxd at HJNaidu. That's HJNaidu. So until next time, just keep watching movies. Bye.